This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
And welcome to the final, the ultimate, I can confidently say the very last episode of Not Alone Podcast in general.
Oh, darn. Way to get my hopes
Jason
up.
Wanted to shut it all down. to the last episode that Not Alone Podcast is going to do on contactees for a very long time. My name's Sam Fredrickson, and I'm promising, pinky promising,
Jason Moitoso? That was weird. You gave me this hand gesture like I should introduce myself.
Yeah, it didn't.
All right.
It worked better in my
you're
head.
You're promising me that this is the end.
This is the last.
This is it for a while.
There is something else I'd like to talk about, but I will defer it for, let's say, at least 6 months. Does that sound fair?
It sounds wonderful.
All right. So, listeners, sit down, strap in. We have no announcements. We have nothing to. Oh, crap. Well, we do have one announcement, which is that remember, next week we're going to do our holiday special. And then the week after that, the week of Christmas, we're not doing anything. We're taking the week off. And you too, you do that too. Spend time with your family. If you don't have family, go listen to like an old episode and pretend we're your family because we love you. Now that's out of the way.
Wow. That took a different turn than I was expecting.
We are ready to put a pin in this. We are both very much done with the contactees, but we made you a promise. We made a holy, solemn vow that we would sit here and we would deliver you a 5-part series, not a 3-part series.
How could we?
And we are here now at part 5 of 5. And as we turn our gaze towards the last of our contactees, the last apostle of the extraterrestrial gospel, we ask you...
Off top of your head right there?
No, I've said that like a total of 7 times in the last 3 episodes.
I mean, it's pretty obvious that I've been...
That's okay. He's out.
Glazing my eyes over doing this.
I ask you to keep an open mind, but if you're not going to... That's fine.
Shut it rather quick, folks.
Today we are going to be talking about the wholly remarkable tale of Orfeo Angelucci. Now, Orfeo Angelucci, he was born in Trenton, New Jersey, in the year 1912, and from the get-go, things weren't going very great for him. His childhood was characterized by, and these are his own words, I'll be quoting him a lot, so I'll be saying, quote, and then unquote, because that's how that works. Quote, constitutional inadequacy, great physical weakness, lassitude, I don't know what that means, lack of appetite and malnutrition. I tired very easily. The slightest physical effort often left me weak and exhausted.
That's the kind of man you want.
Unquote. He's the guy. Now, by the time he reached the 9th grade, his doctor said, you know, you should probably just not go to school. Just homeschool yourself. You're very sick and weak, as if you weren't aware. And he said, yes, I know. And then he did. And
man, life before vaccines, dude.
I know. Life before, like, a lot of things in 1930s would be in the 1930s. I'm surprised they even had school back
then. Not even. 1930, he'd be 18. He's done.
That's wild.
Yeah, he's in the 20s. The roaring 20s.
The roaring 20s. Everybody else's life was great and his sucked. And that just made it even worse.
I've watched Great Gatsby. I know what you're talking about.
Now, what's interesting is it sounds like he pretty much got to direct his own studies. He talked about how he read whatever books he wanted and they were mainly science books. And that's what he liked the most. And as time went on, he realized that it was probably better if he just doesn't return to school. His family went through a huge financial hardship. He doesn't really say what it was, but he says, okay, I'm just going to need to join the workforce. And so he was lucky enough to find a job that would accommodate his physical limitations and needs. His uncle was a small business owner who owned a flooring company, and he was a salesman out on the floor of the flooring company's sales room. Now, he did continue to pursue his science education in his free time, and around the age of 24, he married, he talks about her being, the most beautiful woman, which is very sweet and wonderful, but we're skipping all past this. He marries at 24, they have a son. A year later, he's having the happiest days of his life. Then he has a devastating physical breakdown. He loses a third of his body weight in a matter of months. He was so weak that he could not get out of bed. The doctors diagnosed him with a neurovascular condition, and he was told that he needed complete rest and continuous medical attention. And so from here, he is transferred into a hospital where he actually lives for 18 months, confined to bed and experiencing pain so intense he could not even bring himself to read. Now, every day he found himself wishing that he would just die and get it over with, which I'm sure Jason and I can relate to at this point in the series. That's fine. Jason?
I don't have the will anymore.
He doesn't even have the will to will that. The poor guy, for dollars a day, you can support Jason through these darkest days of his life, episode 5. Now
on our Patreon.
yeah, go to Patreon. All your donations will be given to a Jason in need. So he's in constant pain. He does eventually, though, it gets better. He gets stronger. He lives through it. He returns to work. He returns to his pursuit of scientific knowledge, studying electromagnetism due to a belief that it could answer the biggest questions regarding the creation of the universe and matter itself. However, it hit a little closer to him as well, because whenever he was a child, this electromagnetic forces, they caused him pain and suffering. See, he would always have these acute physical symptoms that occurred whenever there was a lightning storm or a thunderstorm. He would feel weird sensations, and he would feel a large amount of pain accompanied later on with a large amount of anxiety. Because of this perceived connection between electromagnetism and lightning, Orfeo decides to turn his focus of studies elsewhere and instead decides to look at the plant and animal kingdom. Now, specifically, he was looking at fungi and mold. And it's here that his life makes a very interesting and poignant turn. See, in 1946, when he was 34 years old, Orfeo conducted an experiment to determine whether the different conditions in the atmosphere would affect the structure of mold. He attached baskets of mold to 18 naval balloons and sent them up attached to a line. Suddenly, though, the line broke, and the balloons and baskets floated away. Now, as he and his family and friends watched, because he had a weird party for this, a come watch Orfeo launch mold into space party, which I can get behind. It sounds like a good time.
It's like he probably spent all this time trying to get funding for this small research project. And then he finally got it, and everyone's excited for him. And he goes, and then he messes it up.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the thing.
What?
The line mysteriously broke.
Yeah,
did
okay.
It? Did it?
Sure, that just happens. It was thunder.
We all make mistakes, Orfeo. You can admit it.
Well, see, if he was just a Boy Scout, he would have gotten the right knot.
Exactly. I'm an Eagle Scout.
So you know all the knots?
Nope. Oh. None of them. Not a single knot.
That's what we have the internet for, though.
That's true.
So we're fine. Need it. Him. He was
up a creek.
Did he not have a manual?
I'm sure he had a manual. Everybody had a manual back in those days.
That's what I'm saying.
You had to.
You know, rope knots 101.
Yeah, yeah. Now, either his knots weren't good enough, or the line did mysteriously break. Either way, he quite literally watched his hopes and dreams sail away through the air. And as he did, everybody around him starts to, comfort him and be, "Oh, Fail, that's so sad, you poor sickly man. I know you needed a win in your life, and I'm sorry you're not going to get one here."
But well, I mean, hey, he found love at 24. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's better than Jason's doing.
Yeah.
Now, suddenly, out of the air, they see a craft appear. and it started moving towards the rapidly escaping balloons. At first, the group, because they all saw it, they thought it was an airplane. But soon they saw that it appeared to be some sort of a wingless object, round and shiny, chasing after the balloons in the sky and circling around them. Now, unbeknownst to Orfeo during the time, this was the beginning of a covert surveillance operation that would run on him around the clock for the next 5 years. Now, at the age of 36, he moved
to... pretty bad surveillance, then. All right, come on, guys.
Nobody's perfect. No, he saw...
We are about to find out.
He saw one saucer.
That apparently they are perfect.
Well, that's true.
So...
he saw one saucer in 5 years. That's pretty good camouflage, I'll tell you. For around-the-clock surveillance.
Okay, it was around-the-clock surveillance. Sure. Continue, Sam.
Now, at the age of 36, he moves to Burbank, California. Is that where you're from?
No.
Okay. And he does
it. Burbank is more south than I am.
He does it for one main reason: the thunderstorms. See, he had been told that California had very few thunderstorms, and that if they had them at all, they were very weak, and they were not. It was nothing to worry about. And he wanted to find relief because his physical.
Sure.
Yeah.
I don't remember a ton of thunderstorms growing up, but they were powerful when they did roll through. Well, so
the other thing that took him there to Burbank specifically was the Lockheed plant, which is where he worked.
Like Lockheed Martin?
Lockheed Martin. Now it's Lockheed Martin. Back then it was just Lockheed.
Ah.
As he's working there, Lockheed, coincidentally, he was working at least during the same time period, although we can't be for sure if they actually knew each other, that George Van Tassel did. However, the men would work later together and have face-to-face contact during the Giant Rock Interplanetary Spacecraft Convention. However, I didn't really find any references to Van Tassel in the earlier parts of his book. Orfeo had been living in Burbank for about 4 years when his experience took place.
Ooh.
His life-changing moment. Now this was...
and this is where it all goes bad for me.
You had about 22 minutes of just a little weird, and now we're down the rabbit hole, Jason. Now, it was very early in the morning, like 1 or 2 in the morning. He had just gotten off
That's
his...
not early. That's the witching hour, Sam.
I hate you. He had just gotten off of his shift at Lockheed when he was driving home, and he had an extremely alarming experience.
Wait. He was at Lockheed until 1 or 2 in the morning?
Yeah, he worked like the swing shift or something.
Was he a janitor?
He worked on radomes, which were plastic and glass housings for the radar units of the F-94C and F-94B Starfighter jet aircraft.
Cool.
And he was doing that about 2 in the morning.
That seems weird.
Well, you know, that's Jason, so weird. I don't know what to tell you, man. That's where we are. We can't of all of the things we're going to talk about.
Oh, this is just the beginning.
Him
Sam.
Getting off at 2 in the morning is not even
saying,
worth
he
mentioning.
He might have told his wife that, but I think he was up to something else.
The man could hardly stand. You're telling me he had the energy?
Maybe because he was a drunkard.
For a lover?
No.
Oh, you think he was just an alcoholic?
Yeah.
Now, as he's leaving and driving home, he has this extremely alarming experience. He has this overwhelming sense of dread, as well as a prickling sensation moving through his body from his hands up to his scalp. His heart began to palpitate, and he was able to identify this as the archetypal precursor to a thunderstorm, sure to be followed by a great deal of pain. And Orfeo found himself surer and surer of every moment that he was on death's doorstep. He knew, one way or the other, that he was about to die. He has this overwhelming belief in it. Even though, it should be noted, he didn't have that belief often when it came to the thunderstorms, when he was anxious and had panic about them. He just didn't want to go through the pain, which is fine, but the pain comes and goes. Today was something a little different. Now, as he's driving down Victory Boulevard, he noticed a faintly red glowing oval object. It was so dim that he wasn't really sure that it was actually there. In the midst of all the other physical abnormalities that he was experiencing, he thought maybe it was just some sort of an aberration caused by that. But it slowly increased in its brilliance until he could be sure that what he was seeing was actually existing. Now, the object remained in the sky, constant in size and shape, regardless of how his car maneuvered, and as he crossed over the Los Angeles River, he realized that it now appeared that he was getting closer and closer to the object, and he soon found himself right on its tail. Now, he gained more and more ground, and then finally, right before he seemed to catch it, the craft made an abrupt 40-degree turn and shot off up into the sky. However, it seems to have stuttered, stalled. It hung there, naturally in the sky for a moment, and then it disappeared into space. However, in its stead, before I say this, I'll put a link in the show notes to, you can read his entire autobiography, which is, or autobiographical, it's a memoir is what it is, of his time with what's about to happen. And I encourage you all to go and read it, if only because he writes so beautifully. Like, he is actually quite a gifted writer and does a very good job of conjuring imagery and emotions, and it's awesome. So we'll put that in the show notes. But I'm going to go ahead and try to tell you what he says. Now, where the craft had been before its abrupt turn, there were instead two great green balls of light. And they descended down, stopping in front of Orfeo's car, causing him to screech to a complete stop. Now, each of the balls were about 3 feet in diameter and had the appearance of green flame. From the midst of the two orbs, a voice spoke, a deep, strong, masculine voice. Very unlike mine. And Orfeo was unable to remember the exact words, but he did remember the message itself. It's pretty stereotypical. "Do not be afraid, Orfeo. We are your friends. Come on out." And so we did.
Sounds like what a murderer would say.
I know, right?
"Hey, don't worry, little buddy. Come on out here.
And then you got a gun or a knife or something. Yeah. The thing of it is, I don't understand why this happens, other than you just have that idea, and I think he may mention as well, that you're not in complete control. It's almost hypnotic, in a way, especially when you're given commands by the aliens. They'll either peacefully calm you down, they'll make you feel safe and secure, or...
Because internally, you just want it.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever it is.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sure. Let's go on your magic carpet ride.
Sometimes I walk my dog at night and I think about what I would do if I saw like a wolfman coming at me. And on the one hand, I'd be very scared. But on the other hand, I would probably jump towards it and just see what happened. If I just passed right through it or what? Because there's never been a reported fatality of these wolfmen. So I'd probably not die.
They're probably not real.
Well, these are two different options.
Well, there you go.
Now, he does. He exits the vehicle. But this physical toll of pre-thunderstorm symptoms, they took so severe a effect on him that he found himself almost unable to stand, yet he was buoyed up by some unnatural process.
Maybe he is a mutant. Maybe that's how he actually unlocks his powers.
Oh, that's interesting.
Getting struck by lightning.
What's his powers here? Hallucination?
Weakness?
You know, like, the weakness is your strength. No. No, it's not. Your superpower is you suck. That sucks, Orfeo. I'm sorry. Now,
when you're born, you accidentally set the difficulty to insane.
Death March. Now, the voice, it calls to him by name. And it, like I said, he feels like he's buoyed up. He's almost floating around, even though he's moving. He's not right off the ground yet.
So he hears his voice. Oreo.
Orfeo, you jerk.
Sorry.
Now, the voice explains to him that these orbs were simply transmission and reception devices. He was speaking to people inhabiting a different planet. And then came the kicker. Do you remember your 18 balloons and the mold cultures that you lost in the skies back in New Jersey? Do you remember also the strange wingless craft appearing to observe your activities? Then you do. You do remember us, Orfeo.
So wait, now, they cut the balloons?
Shh. Now drink. Yeah, that's the implication. That's the implication, is that the aliens...
Dickhead.
I know. He spent a lot of time, probably a little bit of money on this.
He at least had to get funding.
18 balloons and some mold.
I can't think of naval balloons being cheap. Anyway. Yeah.
I don't want to derail by trying to look up how much or even what a naval balloon is. It's probably just like a really high-tech, not even high-tech, just like thick density.
That's what I was thinking too.
Yeah. Good. I was like, yes. Then you do remember us, Orfeo. Now drink from the crystal cup you will find on the fender of your car, Orfeo. And Orfeo did remember. And a moment before being told to drink, he became acutely aware of the severity of his thirst. He glanced towards his car's fender, and sure enough, there it was. A glistening crystal goblet catching the green light and reflecting it dazzlingly into the night.
So where's that goblet now?
Can I tell you?
Yeah.
He drank. And as he drank, he realized it was the most delicious beverage he'd ever tasted. And as he drank, his pain and weakness were taken from him. And as he thanked the voice and replaced the goblet onto his fender, he saw it disappear.
Of course he did.
Into the night. Like a magic trick.
Whoa! It's like it was never there.
Now, suddenly, the entire area around him began to glow green. The same shade of green as the orbs, and the light itself seemed to be attracted to itself. It's really interesting that the way he talks about it, it's as if each one of the photons had a certain density and gravity towards it that caused them to pool together and then to create a structure. And the structure was a rectangular screen. Now, as the screen appeared, the two discs disappeared. And on the screen, the faces of two beings, a man and a woman, appeared, and they were perfect in every way. They were noble, beautiful creatures.
Of course they were.
Even just gazing upon them moved Orfeo to wonder, and then to something like fear, as he realized that the two impossibly perfect beings looked familiar. He felt naked, unveiled. He was aware that they knew what he was thinking and that they were aware of everything he had ever done, and that he had received a download of some kind of information, thoughts, and concepts. Things were going through his mind and they were making sense faster than he could even think about them. Now, the screen slowly faded and dissipated. And then the light rematerializes as these two glowing orbs. Now this strong, masculine voice comes again from the midst of the flaming spheres, and it says, "The road will open, Orfeo." Now, without speaking, Orfeo felt ashamed. He felt small, as if he, a nobody, was entirely the wrong person to be having this experience.
Oh, he's correct.
But the voice returned, quote, "We see the individuals of Earth as each one really is, Orfeo, and not as perceived by the limited sense of man. The people of your planet have been under observation for centuries, but have only recently been resurveyed. Every point of progress in your society is registered with us. We know you as you do not know yourselves. Every man, woman, and children is recorded in vital statistics by mean of our recording crystal discs. Each of you is infinitely more important to us than your fellow Earthlings because you are not aware of the true mystery of your being. From among you, we singled out three individuals who, from the standpoint of our higher vibrational perception, are best fitted for establishing..." We'll talk about it.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in about half an hour. I know. We're not even close. Right. We're not even close to being done. We barely just started. that are best fitted for establishing contact, all three are simple, humble, and presently unknown persons. Of the other two, one is living in Rome, and the other in India. But for our first contact of the people of Earth, Orfeo, we have chosen you. We feel a deep sense of brotherhood towards Earth inhabitants because of an ancient kinship of our planet with Earth. In you, we can look far back in time and recreate certain aspects of our former world. With deep compassion and understanding, we have watched your world going through its growing pains. We ask that you look upon us simply as older brothers. Unquote. Now, this voice continues talking very, very, very quickly, and it begins to unravel all sorts of mysteries regarding the saucer-shaped craft that had been seen around the world. Now, what it tells Orfeo is that they were actually remote-controlled scout ships with synthetic crystal brains which received direction from the mothership. It records everything it sees, hears, or even telepathically senses as it scours the globe. Now, they describe these recordings as being stored in the Records of Light, which contain a complete history of Earth and everyone who has ever lived on it. Now, the other thing that they said is that the Prime Directive from Star Trek, although in Star Trek, the Prime Directive is that you can't interfere with another planet, a developing species.
Right.
And that's exactly what it seems to be here, is that the extraterrestrials are actually forbidden of reaching out to the people of,
oops,
yeah, of
until when
humanity
who changes that?
Well, you don't really hear, you don't really know. It gets addressed a little later on, but
this guy's just a loose cannon, huh?
He's a loose cannon. That's exactly what he is. You got this.
God. Okay.
Now, there are other oppositional forces at work as well, but these aliens, they care, again, because they are Earth's older brothers. And they will talk to Orfeo again very, very soon. And then the discs fade out, and they flew up high, high up into the air. Now, with that, Orfeo traveled home. Jason, what do you think about all that?
I think it's stupid.
Okay, that's fair. Thanks, bud.
I hate chosen ones.
Yeah, that's fair.
They're only good in movies.
That's fair.
And I'm sorry your life isn't a movie story arc.
I'm just sorry his life is what it was.
That too. I'm tired of it, Sam. I know what
I've forgotten
about
the taste
to continue.
I've forgotten the taste of strawberries, Sam.
No, screw you. You keep your strawberries.
You just take a nap, buddy. Now, Orfeo returned home 3 hours after he had left the plant. I misspoke earlier. Okay, Orfeo.
What?
It took Orfeo 3 hours to get home, and he got home at...
Probably because he was drunk.
No, because he had a freaking extraterrestrial experience, brah. Brah?
Fine. Different
drunk. Brah? He got home at 2 a.m., so he actually left the plant at 11. So, I don't know if that makes you feel any better about the whole thing. Probably not.
No.
Now, Orfeo would return to this spot on a road called Forest Lawn Drive, and he returned there in the following days. He had hoped to find that he was simply dreaming, that he had hallucinated, that the approaching thunderstorm, which never actually came, caused him to go into a panic that allowed his mind to slip away for just a moment. But as he returned to the scene of the contact,
mm-hmm,
he found skid marks on the road in the exact place that he had to slam on the brakes to avoid from smashing into the glowing green orbs. And to Orfeo, that was enough. That was enough to confirm everything that had happened.
And now, then we spiral.
Now, he would drive that road night after night, attempting to establish telepathic communication with the beings. However, he heard nothing for quite some time. But 2 months later, on July 23rd, 1952, he found himself again thrust into the unknown. After staying home sick from work, he went for an evening walk, as he thought that the night air may do him some good. Now he stops in at what he calls the local snack bar, which I'm not sure what that means. He refers to it a lot, and I don't know what a snack bar is.
I'm assuming it's like a mix between a cafe and a like a convenience
store.
Yeah,
that's kind of what I thought too.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. He orders a cup of coffee, and then he and everybody else in the bar laughs and jokes about flying saucers. Here's what's really interesting about Angelucci is...
Okay.
When...
Sure.
I mean, on a, like, a psychological perspective, is that, like, he's never the one causing things to happen. Things always happen to him.
Yeah.
And so in this case,
that's
he talks...
Works, man.
Yeah. He talks about how, like, the waitress wanted to talk about UFOs.
Yeah, but like, it's like the waitress doesn't want to get tipped or something. Yeah, I don't know.
I almost guarantee you that the waitress didn't want to talk about UFOs, and Orfeo really wanted to talk about UFOs.
Coming from a perspective of customer service.
Oh yeah.
I can tell you it was not the waitress that started that conversation.
I would wager money that he was most responsible for what happened. But it's really astounding because when you look at this event, it happened, like I said, about 2 months later, he's laughing about it and he's joking and
yeah, and it feels so weird. Like, can you imagine the whole place just
oh,
UFOs.
Oh, that's a funny little thing you said. It's an interesting juxtaposition because he had kind of started to talk about the UFOs a little more by this point, but he had also stopped. Not stop believing in them, but stop being so sure of what had happened. And so on the one hand, he was laughing and joking along, showing that he wasn't taking everything too seriously. But on the other hand, he kind of felt as though he was betraying himself.
Yeah, wasn't he just lying to himself, trying to, like, laugh it off?
Exactly. Exactly. I really think that that was a part of it. Now, as he left, he thought back to that encounter. He thought back to how serious it had seemed at the time, but how ridiculous it seemed now. Now, he left the snack bar at about 10 p.m., and he continues on this nighttime odyssey. And as he does, he finds himself at the base of the Hyperion Avenue Freeway Bridge, which was the exact bridge that he had used to cross the L.A. River that fateful night. As he approached it, he felt a nervousness descend upon him. He felt a tingling. He felt a prickling. And he felt a dulling of consciousness, the inability to really hear or see or focus with any great detail on any one thing. And as he experienced this, he noticed an odd structure. Now, he described it as the phantom of an igloo, a luminous shadow without substance, a huge misty soap bubble, squatting on the ground, emitting a fuzzy, pale glow. Now, he estimated it to be about 30 foot wide, and as he watched
it... That's a big bubble.
That's a real big bubble. That's a big bubble, I'll tell you. As he watched it, it seemed to substantiate. It gained a solidness and a darkness. However, the structure still had one extremely bright point, an opening, leading inside of it. Now, he finds himself drawn to it, and as he does, he almost unwittingly, but not unwillingly, finds himself entering this igloo. Now, within it is a domed room. It's about 18 feet in diameter, constructed out of something very akin to mother of pearl, which was shimmering and giving off all sorts of light. He found a chair made out of the exact same substance, and although he was not instructed verbally, he knew that he needed to take a seat in this chair. As he did, he realized that the substance responded to him. It molded to his body in such a perfect fit that it seemed to him as though he was simply floating in the air. And as he relaxed, a feeling of overwhelming peace came over him. But
there
then
you go. The drugs are working.
Woo. But then suddenly this door, this portal back to his home, it closed. It snapped closed very, very quickly. And once it did, there was no indication that there had been any door there at all. Now, within the first second after the closure, Orfeo felt extreme fear. He felt an almost complete and total isolation, as if he was lost. As if he did not exist anymore. However, he was presently comforted by good vibes and feelings.
Are we sure he wasn't on drugs?
He feels some really interesting things. Like, that's the thing, is yes, he says interesting things and he sees and hears, but to me, it's the feelings that have so much more of this. Because, like, you listen to George Van Tassel, and Van Tassel's like, I'll tell you, I was astounded upon the spacecraft, and I was taken aback by its beauty, and I felt fear at flying in the air. And then Orfeo is like, I felt as though I no longer exist.
Right? That sounds
that is
a little bit
different.
More like ego death there.
Yeah, exactly. That's,
what are you on, buddy?
That sounds like a more complex emotion. And that's one of the things that I'm talking about, where the way Orfeo writes is just amazing in its own way. It's just astounding because he does. He feels things, whereas others might see things that they don't normally see. He feels things that he doesn't normally feel. And that's what's really quite interesting about him.
And also, before we continue, I think it's poignant to realize that the day his like faith wavers mm-hmm. is the day that he experiences this again.
Exactly.
Surprise, surprise.
Now, he was comforted, like I said, by these good vibes. There was a loud humming which filled the chamber, and the shimmering, sparkling, luminous, and beautiful room began to dim, and the shadow seems to engulf it. And as it does, Orfeo's fears return, and he starts to suffer from a complete nervous breakdown when suddenly a song played.
He's having a bad trip, man.
It really does sound like it. Like,
yeah.
The roller coaster of emotion, mm-hmm. the sudden changes in light and the perception of what's going on, it does sound like he's on drugs, which could mean that Orfeo was, if I don't even know if I want to get into this right now.
MK Ultra.
And the main reason, or the main way that they dosed people was in their coffee. Like, he just said, oh, I had a cup of coffee at the neighborhood bar, and who knows where the coffee came from. Granted, it usually happened.
UFOs.
Well, it usually happened at universities, but even then, the universities were in California. They were around this area that this dosing took place. So it almost does seem like while MK Ultra is thrown out all the time, I would say if there was anyone that was actually MK Ultra, it was probably Orfeo Angelucci. I mean,
from what he's describing, I wouldn't be too like shocked.
Yeah. Now, he hears in that moment, that complete breakdown that he's having, he hears his favorite song begin to play. It's a song called Fools Rush In. I have no idea what it sounds like. I didn't bother. I'm sure it sucks because everything about Orfeo Angelucci
sucks.
Now, in that moment, he realizes they play his favorite song that the beings he was interacting with, they knew him. They loved him. And they wanted him to feel safe and happy. Otherwise, why and how would they know to play this exact song at this exact moment? Now, he feels the craft move, and through this pleasant haze of thought comes the terrifying idea of, where am I going? Where are they taking me?
I have that same thought every day.
And in his own words, he says, he wonders if he was going to, quote, spend eternity lost in space in that pearly igloo. I'll let you guess what happened on that front.
He came down.
Now the chair he was sitting in began to move, turning. And when it did, the song died down. And all that was left sonically was a low, faint hum. Now the chair faced a wall, which opened suddenly. And before him, he saw a great planet, wreathed in rainbow, shimmering and iridescent in space. He was astonished not only by its beauty, but also by the fact that this was happening at all, which is totally something that a high person would do.
Whoa.
Whoa. Oh, wow.
What are you?
Now, he looked down on a world. And that made an impact on him. This idea, like I mentioned in the astronauts astronauts episode, this idea of seeing the world from space, any world from space, it has a effect on you. It changes you. Now, this voice, that masculine yet beautiful, lyrical, musical voice.
More Frank Sinatra?
Started speaking to him gently and kindly. Quote, Orfeo. I've done like four different voices for this guy. And I did that purposefully. Because who's to say what he actually sounds like?
Continuity.
Continuity, be damned. Quote, Orfeo, you are looking upon Earth, your home. From here, over 1,000 miles away in space, it appears as the most beautiful planet in the heavens and a haven of peace and tranquility. But you and your earthly brothers know the true conditions there. Unquote.
You're fucking up.
You screwed up, Orfeo. Why you gotta be such a loser? Now,
like your father.
Come on now, your father's a drinker, you're a drinker, and the world sucks. At this point,
Orfeo, there's a hole in the ozone.
It's, you know what? We're joking, but Orfeo? It's Christmas. It's Christmas, and somebody's mom is going to yell at them soon. And I'm sorry.
I bought you new underwear.
They got holes in them.
Do you need socks?
They got holes in them, and no girl's ever going to want to love you if you got holes in your underwear. Where's my grandbabies?
Okay, by this point, he has a wife and at least one kid that we know of.
Yeah, but
he's got that covered.
Mom's senile.
Ah,
that's okay. The real sadness of all of this.
Man, I thought holidays were supposed to be happy, Sam.
They're definitely
not. You just
not.
Threw a fucking ringer at me.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
Remind me to tell you about the last Thanksgiving I spent with my grandfather.
Oh,
it was
no.
like the worst day of my life. All right, let's move forward here. Otherwise, we are going to die. Now, at this point, Orfeo begins to weep. Not because his mom was yelling at him about his socks, but instead, he wept for the terribleness of Earth and its occupants.
I feel you, bro.
And this voice comes back, quote, "Weep, Orfeo. Let tears unblind your eyes, for at this moment we weep with you for Earth and her children."
Yo, is this guy woke?
For all of its for all of its apparent beauty, Earth is a purgatorial world among the planets evolving intelligent life. Hate, selfishness, and cruelty rise from many parts of it like a dark mist. Orfeo. That was me. I added that last one. That was enough. Unquote. Then the Earth starts to shrink. Slowly but surely, it gets further and further and further and further away, and then suddenly the heavens, the glittering stars and velvet blackness of space presented themselves, radiating the cosmic beauty and the vastness of eternity, and in that chair, Orfeo Angelucci came face to face with God.
That was good.
Thank you.
That was real good.
Thank you. I could be an actor. He knew God. This man who was never really interested in religion or belief. And he knew him in a real, tangible way. Something which permeated all time and eternity. And he knew that the things that he was interacting with were close to God.
Yeah, he's on drugs.
And that through this closeness, they evolved into the beautiful, perfect things they are now.
Let me guess, they're also white.
They're all white. Is that even a question at this point?
No.
We've already addressed racism two or three times in this series, so we're just going to buckle past that one.
It's just good stuff, man.
Now, slowly, a ship comes into view, approaching the window, and as it does, it plays some celestial music. Some unspeakably beautiful melody, which he could describe only as, quote, strange, haunting drifts of melody that brought visions of star galaxies and planets spinning in notes of perfect harmony, unquote. Now, once the ship was fully in view, the voice spoke again, explaining that all of the beings of Earth are immortal and divinely created, and they all exist on a continuum from good to evil. Now, to drift through life without doing good is evil. And Orfeo asked them to grant him strong physical health, and with it he would spend his whole life helping to free his brothers from their bondage, helping to renew the earth, helping to make a difference. If only they can grant him respite from these problems that had plagued him all his life. And then the aliens. These aliens who could create ships out of raw energy and manifest interdimensional visions of space-time told him that they could not heal him. But that's okay.
What jerks.
I know.
Clearly they have advanced medical technology.
They obviously have something going for them, at the very least.
Just like Jesus, he had to suffer, right?
Well, right. That comes into it, sure. Basically, what it comes down to, theologically, these are very different reasons, but in its own way, you're right.
Isn't suffering and pain close to piousness?
Yes, the mortification of the flesh, as it were. That's really big with monks and that kind of crowd. Now,
he is Italian.
That's great and true. Now, what it comes down to is that it created this environment where Orfeo was humble. His sickness allowed him to have access to the higher powers because if he was strong, he wouldn't have to rely on the higher powers.
I wonder what happened to the other two guys.
Yeah, they're not. They may come up. I skimmed the book. I didn't find anything about them. So they probably got real buff. And then the aliens were like, we don't want them anymore. He was told that his weakness was his strength.
Who would have thought?
As a callback there.
Is he going to bring balance to the Force as well?
No, but he can bring light to the world. He can use his weakness to spread this word. Now, he was told that he would overcome his sickness in another way. However, one that doesn't have to do with physical strength, but rather intellectual and emotional strength, with spiritual health instead of actual health. And through this wisdom that they would impart to him, he would become enlightened. He would know so much more about science than he did before, and so much more about spirituality than he did before, because they go hand in hand for these aliens. Now, much more than that was that we, the people of Earth, through him, would be able to find within us peace and brotherly love, not pain and anger, if he would do his job and preach his gospel. Now, Angelucci has literally written hundreds of pages on what follows here. On the hidden and esoteric knowledge revealed to him by the ancient people, and while that is entirely my bag and what I love to read about, it would take multiple episodes to try to unravel all of them and piece them together. So let's just hit some of the highlights.
Why can't we just shake the magic eight ball and try again later?
Nope. People depend on us. Now, the first highlight, as it usually seems to be with aliens for some reason, is Jesus.
Of course.
Now,
where else do you start?
Aliens always have something to say about Jesus. And when it comes to the contactees, they are the most vocal and the most well fleshed out. Now, Orfeo was told, as far as I can understand, that Jesus was the spirit of the sun. Now, I know that starts out sounding all right, but then you realize that he says sun as in S-U-N, as in the great gaseous ball of flame.
Okay, so he's like Apollo now, essentially?
Kind of, no, but still. He is the spirit of the sun, which became flesh out of compassion for mankind, and through his sacrifice, he embedded himself in our spiritual DNA. He fused with what the aliens call the oversoul of man and the world spirit. There's Jason. There he goes. Bye, bye, Miss American Pie. All right. Now,
I'll pick up with you later.
All people of Earth have an immortal spiritual self, which is part of this oversoul of man. Now, time. Time is a byproduct of free will and only exists in order to allow mankind to make their own choices. The most famous of the bad choices that have been made, the fall in the Garden of Eden, led to the separation of each man from his eternal soul. This is a very interesting concept, which is not fully explained, but essentially what it sounds like is that there are us, people, and then there are our souls, somewhere else, waiting to be reunited with us. Now, sin is just lying. Lying is the base core sin, which is not the case in Christianity.
Oh, shoot.
Or Judaism. That's really all it is. And so to Orfeo, to be sinless, you simply have to live an authentic life. If you are truly yourself, unapologetically true at every moment, then you are sinless. And we all know those people who, I'm not trying to be rude, but I'd just like to tell you that those earrings look terrible on you. I'm just telling it like it is. I'm just being honest. And we know that those people are not just telling it like it is. They're just being rude. They're just jerks who want to be jerks and hide it under this guise of just telling it like it is. And those are the people that we hate most of all. But to Orfeo, that's the way to do it. That's how you should be living your life. Now, Orfeo then describes this baptism by light, which conferred upon him the knowledge that time is simply an outpouring of eternity, a segment of eternity rising from it and then falling back into it. Now, this is not a new concept by any means. It is fundamental to most Eastern spiritual thought, but this divine knowledge literally knocked Orfeo out, and he experienced what he knew to be death. However, he awoke later in his own home, although Earth would never be his home again, or so he says. Jason's hitting himself. Jason, what's wrong? Thank you, Jason, for your valuable contribution.
Why? Why is it the last, like, 2.5 weeks of talking about this kind of stuff, it's always been essentially an alien mask over some sort of Judeo-Christian religion?
Yeah.
Why?
Right?
Why?
I've said it multiple times.
Be original.
Do your own thing. That's already been done. Do your own thing.
It's so hard to believe it if it's already been done.
Well, but that's the thing, is it's not a mask over it.
It is.
Right, I know it is. But according to Angelucci and Van Tassel and everyone, it's the truth behind it. Christianity is the mask by which the true message and meaning of these things are hidden.
Deceit for 2,000 years.
Yes, yes. Now, this was the experience. Orfeo before had talked about the saucers to people and kind of mentioned them here and there, but here he was deputized by the ETs. He was recruited to spread this word, and spread it he did.
Hey, Sam.
Yes?
Let's open up a diner called Flying Saucers.
Ooh, now that's pretty good.
And we just serve soup.
Well, I hate soup. It's probably my least favorite of foods.
I'll serve soup. You can be on roller skates so you can bring them out to food.
Nice. I love that.
And they're flying.
Now,
you gotta be real careful though, because momentum in water is not great. Liquids, you know, don't come to a quick stop without, you know, be ready to catch the
pure
liquid.
Away. Yes,
and flying saucers, we can't stop. No, that's and change the point. Direction that
that's
quickly.
The point is that see, we'll talk about like non-ballistic motion, and that'll be incorporated in how we deliver soup to people.
Because it splattered all over their bodies.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Perfect.
That's what you pay for. Goods right there. And then you get a free shirt.
Well, we have to give them a shirt because they're covered in tomato sauce.
Bingo.
That's pretty much our bad. Now, Thanks, Chase.
I think we already got this down.
Well, let's just close it. That's there's no more Not Alone podcast. We own a diner now. We don't have time for this. Goodbye.
It's all chrome.
Like in SpongeBob?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know it.
Good Lord.
Oh, and you have to paint up being yourself all green and stuff. You got to look like an ogre.
That's just ignorant to say that to say that the aliens are green. Hey, we know they're white.
We know that. All right, fine. You got to bleach your hair then, Happy. All
right, I'll do that. I need to get Aryan AF. All right.
Oh, God. And I'm back. Okay.
Jason Continue. Has returned. So
rejuvenated.
He does. He is deputized. He is told to go spread this good news of hope and ET life and whatever. And he does. He does spread it. And
have you heard about Alien Jesus?
Can I tell you the story of our Lord and Savior, Alien Jesus? He does spread this. But what's really, to me, sets him apart from everyone else is that he spreads it not like Van Tassel, who had conventions and weekly meditation sessions wherein he set himself up as a guru. Not like Adamski, who just sold book after book after book. Orfeo begins and for years spreads this by just telling absolutely everyone. Everyone that he meets that will give him the time of day, he talks the ear off of, trying to explain what
happened to him. So he's like a preacher
in
the quad.
Exactly. He is the man on the street corner shaking his alien Bible at you.
The end of Nigh.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Now, because of this, by his own account, he quickly became the butt of many jokes.
What?
Right. But this didn't bother him.
Of course
he
not.
He transcended above and beyond the things of this world.
He was on a divine path.
Yes. Now, this is why I mentioned it last week. Orfeo Angelucci is the only person that I believe in, that I believe that what he says happened to him, he believes happened to him. I don't know if I believe that it happened to him.
I agree. He's crazy.
But Van Tassel, Adamski, and Fry, their motives were a little too...
material?
On the sleeve. You could see them right off the bat, I would say.
Was it their hearts?
No.
Oh.
It was cash.
Hard.
Hard cash. Cold cash.
That's the way it be.
Yeah. Now, Orfeo...
Where did that come from? Cold, hard cash.
Have you ever hit somebody with a stack of $100 bills? It hurts.
No.
It hurts bad.
I have not. What is it, cold?
Yes. Now, thank you.
You've been, wait. You've been hit by a stack of $100 bills, Sam?
You know.
Sam, I really wish I knew you in your younger years.
All right, we're moving forward here. Now,
what kind of rings did you like hang out in?
This was no quick movement to get rich. He acted like a man who had literally, or who had legitimately come face to face with something above him, and it transformed him. But as will always happen in spiritual experiences, when time elapses from that first transitional or transformational event, and you go further and further and further and further, doubt creeps in. And he begins to worry that maybe he was crazy.
So now he's going to get another visitation. Oh, am I ruining it for everyone?
Well, here's the difference. He is worried that he is crazy and that maybe it didn't happen. But he does instead this little self-check. And when he does this self-check, he realizes it's true. And it has to be true. And he just double-checks everything and he's good to go. But he does still have doubts. And especially as he's being ridiculed, he says that it doesn't matter and he's beyond it, but it totally matters, as we'll see here. Because on August 2nd, his wife Mabel and he were at a drive-in theater working at the concession stand, I believe. They're helping out, is what he said. So I don't know if they were getting paid or not, but whatever. Now, he stepped away again for some fresh air, and he noticed a fuzzy green light in the sky. Now, he went and got Mabel and seven or eight others who all witnessed it as well. However, nobody thought it was a UFO. They all talked about being a street light or something. And they all watched, according to Orfeo, they all watched the street light ascend into the sky and disappear. But they all just said it was still a street light. And they laughed at him and they left. And Orfeo was so distraught by this that he decided he was going to walk home alone. Did that ever happen to you as a kid? Like, your friend or somebody made fun of you and you're like, screw this, man, I'm going home. And you just, like, walk home alone. That ever happened to you? Happened to
no,
me?
No, I lived in the country. Oh. Oh, walk home was like 10 or so miles.
Idyllic summer days. The Elysian fields.
Nah, screw that, man.
I did that.
I had allergies.
I was a very sensitive child. And so
Really?
Really. And so when kids would make fun of me.
You're so, like, stoic now.
Even. Thank you. When kids, when, like, my friends would get mad at me or make fun of me or something, I'd always be that kid who was just like, well, I'm just going to go home. I know where I'm not wanted. And then I'd walk home. And that's what Orfeo's doing. But he's a grown-ass man. Now.
Well, this is what happens when you don't socialize in high school.
It's true. It's really true. You gotta have that high school socialization. Now, as he's going home, as he's walking, he comes again to the Hyperion Avenue Freeway Bridge, where his previous encounter had taken place. But there was no indication of any sort of otherworldly craft. And this made him sad. More sad. Yep. He was sure. I mean, he saw it. He saw the light. And it was in that general direction. Instead of there being a craft, there was a shadowy man who moved towards Orfeo with alarming speed and suddenness.
Skinwalker.
Ooh. And Orfeo was worried that he was about to be mugged.
Perfect. But could be worse.
It's California. It happens.
Hey. You're not wrong.
Thank you.
You're now, very correct there.
He felt his fight or flight response start to get off, but before it could go all the way, the man calls out to him saying, "Greetings, Orfeo." I'm going to let you have one guess as to who this guy is.
Is it the same guy you've been trying to to interpret the entire time?
Yes. Now,
because he sounds different again.
I know he does. In this moment, Orfeo realized it was Jason. You got it. That same voice he had heard multiple times. The sound of the entity that had been communicating with him. And then Orfeo knew that this being's name was Neptune. And there was this moment where Orfeo wants to call him Neptune. And then the being says, yes, you may call me that, without him saying it. And he says, Neptune? And he says, yes. Now he and
Neptune, God of the sea.
God of the sea.
You are correct. Why not?
I am also known as Poseidon, brother of Zeus. Now, he and Neptune, they had another one of their hidden knowledge sessions. This time, what was conveyed to him was that Earth was not mankind's original home, but rather there had been another planet in our solar system. One that was perfect, with no pain, sickness, or death. But the inhabitants of that planet, they grew proud, and they turned against God, destroying their own planet, which became the asteroid belt. And mankind...
Oh, reminds me of some other disaster that swept things away.
What are you talking about? The biblical flood?
Yeah.
Oh, well, this is literally just the story of the fall of Satan, anyway. It's like, everything's perfect, and then the angels rebelled, and then they got cast down and to Earth, as we're going to see.
Perfect.
So,
super stoked about this, too.
So glad it's happening. And at that point, man was introduced to, I wrote here dearth, but I meant to write death. Man was...
Dearth. That's what I've been introduced to.
Man was introduced to death and reincarnation. A continual spiritual progression until he reaches that past perfect state.
I hate all of this.
Now Armageddon looms on the horizon for Earth, closer than any man would dare to think, mainly due to communism. And in the future...
Of course it is. Yep.
In the future, this terrible time will be known as the Great Accident, but Orfeo...
Well, we can come up with a better name. The great oops.
Whoops-a-daisy. That's how they'll...
I mean, we've come up with some really cool names for extinctions and stuff. We've had the mass dying.
I just see like kids in the year 3000 looking back, and there's like a header on their textbook that's
the
just
great
like,
accident.
Whoopsie daisy.
No, we're not talking
1980
about
1980 to 2010. The great accident, and it's a picture of themselves because it's the year 3000, and we have this technology. Good. Now, mankind was going to survive this cosmic whoops-a-daisy, and they would end up better for it. Orfeo then noticed the form of this man, who he described only as great, grand, and impressive. But this form seemed to waver, as if he was not physically solid. And then he claimed that because he had been talking for so long, he, Neptune, god of the sea, was thirsty. We should note that he did not introduce himself as the god of the sea.
Right, but we can't be for sure if he isn't.
That's true. Now, Orfeo runs to the corner store to get him something to drink. He gets him some lemon soda, which if I asked for water and somebody brought me lemon soda,
can I get some squirt?
What are you talking about? This doesn't hydrate me at all.
God, soda.
As he
humans,
as he,
that is the great accident.
This is the whoops-a-daisy. As he runs to the store, he looks behind him and he sees again that great igloo shape that he had seen those months before. But when he returns, Neptune was gone. Now, Orfeo,
because he knew he was getting squirt.
Well, if I'm not gonna get something refreshing and hydrating, I'm leaving this god awful planet.
Didn't he just realize he could just materialize it like he did previously?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they made a crystal goblet appear out of nothing. All right. Now, Orfeo, as you might imagine, had very, 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 very many more different multitudinous numbers of experiences.
Multitudinous. Lovely.
But there is one last highlight from his life that I want to hit before we wrap up here. It's what Orfeo called, quote, the most beautiful and revealing of all of my experiences with the etheric beings, unquote. What?
No, I just know it's coming next.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this took place...
Spoilers.
It's kind of hard to say when it took place, but we'll say it took place at the very end of the summer of 1953. But the setup for it had been taking place for the entirety of 1953. Now, it began in January when he lost an entire week of time. Now, when he was talking to his wife, named Mabel, about this, she didn't notice anything amiss. He had gone to work, he'd come back, he had gone to work, he'd come back, and he did that 7 times. But as much as Orfeo tried over and over to try to remember these days, he was just unable to do so. However, he felt as though something very significant must have happened. He described laying on a couch, recovering from some flu-like symptoms, and then suddenly he was at work, at Lockheed, with his friend inches from his face, looking genuinely concerned and saying, "Are you all right, boy?" Now, he fled...
Boy.
Boy.
That's a little...
Diminutive? Yes.
Yeah.
Now, he fled from work and saw on the street a newspaper with the date of January 19th, which was 7 days later than when he was reclining on the couch. But he had absolutely, it wasn't even like he blacked out. It was that he was on the couch 1 minute and he was running through the streets the next 7 days later. But another really extremely odd sensation that he had been having for a while was felt most prominently while attending a UFO convention in Hollywood. Now, he was speaking with people when he felt himself, he would say, overshadowed by another personality. He felt himself being someone or something else, and this other person didn't think in either Italian or in English, but rather some unidentifiable language with which Orfeo was able to understand in the thinking of it, but could not even remember a syllable of what it sounded like or seemed like after the fact. Now, this personality would only come over him when he was addressing a very large group of people, and it would make it exceedingly difficult for himself to conduct himself in an understandable fashion, and yet his audiences continually came and thanked him and said, "Thank you for your valuable insight. Oh, your speech was so good. The truths you shared were revolutionary and life-changing," but he couldn't remember what he had been sharing. Now, these two...
So Neptune just needed a pawn.
Yeah, pretty much.
He just needed a body.
He just needs a guy.
And this feeble young man.
Feeble man. Yes, exactly. If he got buff, Neptune couldn't fight him. I don't even know if I mentioned it. Or I know I mentioned it. Like, his body was wavering when they met under the bridge, almost as if he was like a hologram from Star Wars.
Yeah.
So he definitely couldn't have taken anybody buff. Now, these two phenomena, the almost possession-like experience, as well as the missing time, they converged in the first week of September, when he suddenly remembered with perfect clarity the events of those 7 missing days in January. However, to his surprise, they had not taken place on planet Earth.
What? I am so surprised.
As
shocked.
He drifted off to sleep on the 12th of January. He woke elsewhere. And when he did, he knew that he was no longer on Earth. He awoke on a luxurious couch on another world.
Oh, man. Couches. You know what I'm
saying?
They're
the best.
Yeah.
Nap on a couch? Can't beat it. Can't beat it.
Sleep on a couch?
Not as great.
Yeah.
Short intervals. As he glances down at his body, he realized it was not his body at all. It was much too beautiful. He was wearing a fine white garment, a tunic with a gold belt of heavy, or I should say large, gold links. But the links were weightless. And he realized that he himself was weightless, or very close to it. He felt vibrant and joyful. He felt truly alive. He had had the feeling that he had been recovering from a sickness, and this is why he was in this room, whatever this room was. It was composed of soft, ethereal, glowing colors, but lacked a definite structure. The colors were unlike anything he had ever seen, and suddenly, in a very trippy move, he recovered more memories. Memories within the memories. Memories which provided context to the memories. He remembered not as Orfeo, but he remembered as this other person. And he realized then, awakening to a different form of life he had lived or maybe continued to live. And he remembered all of it. He remembered that this was his true home. And his exact words were, quote, "I remember this world. I remember it in the same way that a condemned prisoner remembers the sunshine, the trees, the flowers of the outside world after an eternity chained in a dark and odious prison. This is my real world, my true body. I have been lost in a dimension called time and captive in a forbidding land called Earth, but now somehow I have come home," unquote. Now, one of the walls opened, and there appeared a beautiful woman dressed in a Grecian gown, with golden hair and very large blue eyes. She seemed to have shimmering waves of translucent color coming off of her, and through these memories within memories, Orfeo knew and understood that this was a method of communicating thought and emotion, these waves. And he remembered her as well, but he could not place her. She touched the wall opposite to where Orfeo reclined, and when she did, it became as shimmering glass, reflecting him in full length, and he realized he was definitely not Orfeo. Yet whoever he was someone familiar. Someone he knew, yet didn't know.
Ooh.
Now he remembered her name, and he spoke it. He called her Lyra, and she nodded. He asked if he may go outside to see the rest of this place, his beautiful, true home. And Lyra shook her head and said, "You're not strong enough, but I promise that before the 7th day, you shall see all, Neptune." Bum, bum, bum! Now, as you may imagine, Orfeo was astonished by this. He was not Neptune. He knew Neptune, that beautiful, mysterious, wavery-like stranger who had broken intergalactic codes of conduct. Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention that. They talk about that prime directive. They have, like, this little test that they do. Neptune tells Orfeo about the prime directive and the hands-off policy and that he cannot interact with human beings. It's simply not allowed. They especially cannot be permitted to physically interact with each other. And then he goes through and tells them all of these things about Earth and the destinies of the planets and this and this and that. And then he extends his hand and Orfeo wants to shake his hand, but he remembers that he can't. And so he doesn't. And he says Neptune weeps with joy that he passed his test. So there's that.
But he already broke the code in telling him all.
Yeah, but like that's one code. So the touching, no touching is the real big intergalactic code.
Germs, I get it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So that was Neptune. This is Orfeo. He's not Neptune. He knew Neptune, and he was not Neptune. But then another man appears coming out of the wall, and Orfeo remembers him as Orion. And Orion walks to him saying, "We have missed you, Neptune." And at this point, Orfeo tells him they're mistaken. He is not Neptune. He spoke with Neptune. And even in this body and place, he knew that he was not him.
Orion.
Thank you. Well, I'm really proud of you for following along with the notes. I kind of thought you had just closed them a while ago, which is fine.
No, I am right here. Like
just
always.
Trying to scroll down to see how much is left. We're actually just about there.
Yeah, we're close. We're closing in.
Orion explains to him that the being he had met was not Neptune, but rather Astra. The name Neptune had come to Orfeo because it was his own name.
Of course it was.
In another time, at another place. But even here, even now, this is not objective reality. What you, Neptune, are experiencing, they, Orion and Lyra, were still clothing themselves in matter. They were still projecting themselves to him in a form which echoed the longing in Orfeo's soul for the time before the destruction of humanity's first home, for that is where he is now. In a remembrance of material fact, they manifested in the highest dimension that Orfeo had known, but if he had known a higher one, they would be there instead. Now, he slept. This was a lot. This was a lot to take
clearly.
In. He slept, and when he awoke, the wall had transformed again opposite him, and this time there was a great balcony overlooking the beautiful, perfect world humanity had left behind, a dream world full of color with buildings made of crystal and inhabited by people described as statuesque. Now, he saw below a great garden, beautiful beyond description, in which Orion and Lyra were reclining. They invited him down and gave him another mystical history lesson. They told him that this planet, this pre-Earth, was called Lucifer, and its orbit was between Mars and Jupiter. It was the most radiant planet in all the universe, and the ruler of this planet was also Lucifer, who most people are going to be able to pretty readily identify as the name of the devil. Now, the Judeo-Christian legends, he was told, are true. This beautiful being, the light bringer and morning star, rebelled against his father God. When they obviously lost, they were cast down. Now, you mentioned earlier, what do these talks of higher vibrations, what does that mean? Essentially, their matter on this planet, world, it vibrates at a higher frequency.
So it's more energetic, so it's hotter.
Yes, sure. Thanks, science guy. You think you're so smart? Their matter vibrates at a higher frequency, which gives them this weightlessness. Because their frequency is higher, they do not interact with matter in the same way. They interact with it, I suppose you would say, less often. Obviously, that's not necessarily correct because you're always interacting with matter, but it just has less of an effect on them. Now, when mankind and the rebelling monstrous ones who rebelled against God and joined Lucifer, when they were cast down, they were cast through the vibrations down. Their vibrations were lowered, and their matter became more dense and solid, crude and vulgar. And their world was destroyed, and they were confined to Earth to suffer and be refined. Now, Lyra and Orion were members of that race which did not rebel. And when their planet Lucifer was shattered, they and their cohorts ascended to a higher realm, closer to God. Orfeo was one of the rebels, but as Lyra told him, he was one of the most reluctant to join the rebellion. And you get this again, this idea that good and evil exist on a continuum. Yes, he was technically evil, but he was a lot less evil than pretty much everybody else. He was actually the most good of all of the evil people.
Okay.
Now, it is this... It is this love.
Whatever you say, man.
This love of the good progenitors of humanity which reach down and try to rescue those who have descended through the vibrations. Their disc, the flying saucers, they serve many purposes, but one of the most important is that of the harbinger of a new age, a foreteller of the resurrection promised by the sun's spirit to be raised from corruptible matter into incorruptible, from lower vibrations to higher, and to rejoin their fellow family in the higher state of being. And it's very beautiful. And Orfeo cries a lot. And he says, I can't believe I would do that. And they say, don't beat yourself up. It's fine. A lot of people did. And in fact, everybody you've ever known did. And again, you're not too terribly bad.
Hey, you skipped over the sleazy stuff.
No, I'm not. I'm not. Okay. I'm about to talk about that in my favorite bit. But
oh, good.
He does. He feels shame and sadness. But they tell him, you know, you can make it right. You can be better. You can do better. And he says, okay. And they go and they do things. Like at one point, they have a big dinner together at a very long table with crystal goblets and stuff. And 12 other people come in and they're all eating together and drinking the most delicious drinks and eating the most delicious food. And at this point, Orfeo realizes that Lyra's kind of hot. And he wishes that they could, you know... And when he did, literally everybody stopped talking. Like I said, there were 12 others with him. So
you
there
don't
were 15
do this at the dinner table.
Exactly. There were 15 of them all in all. 12 others stopped talking. Lyra and Orion stopped talking. They all look at Orfeo. And he suddenly remembers that he is also emanating these waves that essentially translate his thoughts into a physical, visible form. And he's pretty embarrassed, as you may think. And it's at this, you try to wonder what this illustrates, like why he even included this in the book, other than he was just trying to be truthful. And like, if this is a psychological effect, like why this happens. And I think what it is it illustrates to him, he goes through these 7 days of learning and spending time and coming back to his home, and he feels right, and he feels at home there. And then this episode takes place. And I think what it does is it reminds him that he is not like them. It reminds him of who he is as a base-deprived right. human being. And it essentially breaks the fantasy. It breaks the magic. And it breaks the idea that he can stay there forever. And so, go he must.
Well, he shouldn't have screwed up.
Right. If you could have been better like your brother. But before he left for home, he was shown a vision. And this is where that cardinal not alone rule of the apocalypse comes in.
What?
Don't put a date on it.
Ah, yes. Clearly.
He's shown a vision of the year 19. So we already know it's bad. 1986.
When that one's expired.
Throw it out. We need another. When the end of the world was supposed to take place, and that was the last chance that the men of Earth had to redeem themselves. The last opportunity to rescue themselves from themselves through the aid of these other higher beings. They will either ascend to this higher level, this place that Orfeo was in. He was told they could be in again, or they would be cast down. again through the vibrations to a lower, worse form of matter. Orion looked him in the eyes and said, quote, as you love your brothers of Earth, Orfeo, fight to your dying breath to help them towards a world of love, light, and unity. Unquote. Then he left Orfeo alone with Lyra. She smiled.
Oh, really?
She smiled at him one last time, giving him a look of unconditional love. And then he blacked out. And the next thing he remembered was his coworker looking him right in the face, saying, are you all right, boy? Now, after this, Orfeo...
How old was this man that he was working with? Because let's be honest. Orfeo's what, like 40s,
40, 50s? 40, I think. 40 or 40. No, yeah, 41.
Yeah, he ain't no boy no
more. Boy! It was after this that Orfeo suddenly no longer had the stomach for work. He could not bring himself to perform the same meaningless tasks.
Is that
tasks.
All it takes?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think one, I much have the stomach for it either,
one
Sam.
One real bad trip, or a real good trip, and then you're never going to want to work again, I'll tell you. He didn't have the ability to perform the same meaningless tasks day after day, and so he quit his job, and he went full-time on the E.T. gospel circuit. However, unlike Adamski and Van Tassel, he did not gain this name recognition, this worldwide acclaim. He was known within his circle. Like I said, he did go to the Giant Rock Interplanetary Spacecraft Convention. He even spoke there. But whereas other people, even in passing, may have heard the name Van Tassel or the George Van Tassel or George Adamski, most people have never heard of Orfeo Angelucci, at least not until Astonishing Legends did like a three-parter on him. So if this isn't enough for you, go listen to them. I guarantee it's some good stuff. Now, his stories did draw attention, though, because of their depth and the richness of the narrative, as well as the things that they seem to be trying to tell about the individual who's having them. And we've kind of pointed them out along the way. They attracted the interest, especially of one quite illustrious member of society, Carl Jung. Now, Jung studied Angelucci's literature in depth. He never actually met the man, but he studied the literature in depth to try to understand why these things emerge from our psyche, because he believed him, albeit not in a literal sense. He believed that there was a message of worth in it, and that that message was that the inhabitants of the saucers are us, but we are not what we seem to be, which is totally something I would expect Carl Jung to say. Now, Angelucci would publish three more books before the end of his life in 1993, when he died just months before Jason and I were born, tragically. I would have loved to share some of the Earth space with him. He never, as far as I can tell, and I will be honest that at this point in the research, I did not care to know, if he ever did acknowledge the fact that he died 7 years after the end of the world, or what was going on with all of that, because unlike a lot of these prophecies where it's like, we stop the end of the world by being good in this, there were two very distinct outcomes here, neither one of which is things just keep going on the way they are. So, but that's okay. That's all right.
Is it?
No.
Because it sounds like he's wrong.
Now, he has been largely forgotten by the mainstream skeptics and believers.
Good for them.
But he still established a narrative.
Ah.
Much closer to a real religion than anything else. And in his own way, he contributed more to the New Age movement, in my opinion, than pretty much anyone else. Now, with these four men we've talked about, it's impossible to say exactly who influenced who and to what degree. It is fairly safe to say that none of them could have existed without each other in their own way. And together they form a tapestry, a picture, a luxurious oil painting of a subject which we can only call the Space Brothers, the spreaders and propagators of the intergalactic gospel of peace, love, and good vibes. Without them, ufology would be much changed, for better, probably, for worse, probably not. And although we may not like it, although we may not agree with it, we have to accept it, that these men were who they were.
And we can move past it.
And we can
That's
move past
point.
It.
That's how I'm going to accept this.
As we do now. So here at the end of our 5-part series.
Hallelujah.
Part 5 of 5 or part 3 of 3. We would like to thank you for your patience. We'd like to thank you for your joy. We'd like to thank you for your feedback. We've gotten a lot of people saying that somehow or another they've enjoyed all of this.
Oh, God.
And it's made them laugh. And it's brought them happiness this time of year. And if this is not a labor of love, especially on Jason's part, as he has not at all actually walked out at any point, I don't know what is.
I've had, like, frustration headaches for the last 3 weeks.
Yeah. So, next week, we'll be back with something completely different. And we hope to leave the contactees in our rear view for quite a while, if not forever. We'll return talking about other UFO religions at another time. But for now, we look forward to next week and the week after, and we wish you all happy holidays and good vibes. And remember...
Who are we, the Beach Boys?
That the Space Brothers love you, and so do we.
Yeah.
Now, I wish I could just end it there, but we do have to do those things that we do.
Okay.
I'm going to make them real quick.
The normal stuff.
We'd like to thank, we have one new patron this week. Thank you for keeping the lights on. There are two lights in this room, but there are more outside. Who knows?
Sam, can we drop this analogy?
There are three lights.
We have beat it dead.
I know. And I love them all. If you want to learn how you can become a patron and hear all of the terrible jokes that I edited out of this episode, as well as get access...
Or every curse word I've said this time around.
Every curse word.
It was a few.
Every curse word from the last 60 episodes.
You could make it a drinking game if you like.
You could make like a supercut of all of the curse words if you wanted. You can find that. You can become a patron at Not Alone Podcast or at patreon.com/Not Alone Podcast. That really helps out. That's a wonderful way of supporting the show. The other wonderful way of supporting the show is through iTunes reviews. We'd like to thank Santos Dave, who left us our only iTunes review this week. He says, "Not Alone, best podcast ever. Short, sweet, to the point. It's exactly what I needed this episode." Thank you, Santos Dave.
Now, has he never heard of any other podcast?
I know, right?
So strange.
So there's like this, I'm sure you've seen like these end of the year Spotify roundups that people are doing, and they do them for music as well as podcasts. And like,
oh, interesting.
There are at least 2 or 3 people who we are the podcast they listen to the most this year. And then there was one point when Spotify like tweeted and was like, "What was your favorite podcast that you heard this year?" And one person was like, "Not Alone Podcast." I was like, "Really? Wow." He said, "Not Alone Podcast, followed closely by Astonishing Legends." And I was like, holy crap. Our entire life is just, it's like they're our older brother. And I want to beat them, but I love them. So that sort of a thing.
We just have to get some stand-up lessons.
Right? We need to go to improv class. We really could too. My buddy teaches it. We could do it. Those sorts of things literally keep me going. Like, I would not have finished this series if it wasn't that I kept getting people being like, "Oh, I love this. This is so good. This is so funny. This is whatever, this, that, and the other thing." So thank you. Your encouragement means the world to us and to all of your other favorite creators. I guarantee it. So this Christmas season, if all you can do is send a note of joy their way, do it. It's going to make their day. So, other than that, you can find us on Twitter at Not Alone Pod. You can find me on Twitter at Beerlord Elfbane. You can find Jason on Twitter at
Mighty Moit.
You can find us at Not Alone Podcast at Facebook.com. You can find us in our Facebook group. Remember, we are Not Alone, a community for the strange. And we can be found as well at notalonepodcast.com. You can reach out to us at notalonepodcast@gmail.com. And you can send in your stories to be considered for contribution to later episodes at notalonepodstories@gmail.com. That's all I got. I did it last week and it was terrible. So I need you to do it real good this week.
Okay. Remember, whether you're a fool rushing in, or you make an embarrassing remark at the dinner table.
No.
You are
not alone.